All right, we're going to continue with the Westminster Confession of Faith, Chapter 9 of Free Will. Section 2, man, in his state of innocence, he had freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing to God, but yet mutably, so that he might fall from it. We begin this week with the first of the four states in which man has or will exist. This is a state of innocence. And in this state, man was able to will sin or not to will sin. He was able to will to sin or not to will to sin. In this state of innocence, all things being equal, he had the ability of both. And that's important to understand as we go through this. That equation is going to change a little bit, whether or not he is able or not able to do this or to do that. So he was able to do good or to sin. And when we're saying that, I'm saying that not simply in terms of the externality of the action, but in terms of the internal or intentionality of the action, that internal aspect of the action that is known only to God and maybe sometimes to the person who is enacting. So we want to talk about man in his state of innocency, that is prior to the fall. The reason for that is that after the fall, something happens to the nature of the man. There are two aspects of the will. The source of the will, that is, it is an attribute of what, and the agent of the will, an attribute of who. So when we ask of what, in innocency, we're going to say this is, will, first of all, is an attribute of nature. It's not a property of the person. So will, as an attribute of nature, in innocence, is, in fact, an attribute that is untainted naturally. Right? As it is, in fact, going to be enacted through the agency of a person, Adam is yet unfallen. So the person, the agent enacting, that is, giving expression to this will, that agent is also unfallen. And that's important because that eventually has bearing on all of the other questions. You know, how the will is after the fall, after regeneration, and in glory. We have to consider it in those two relations, as it is an attribute of nature, and as it is, in fact, enacted personally. And so those are both aspects of the will that need to be taken into account. Now, in a state of innocence, what we're saying is neither the nature, not being tainted by sin, there is nothing in the nature that is going to keep it from willing that which is good, nor the person being corrupted, the agent being corrupted by sin. There is not going to be any personal enacting that, in fact, is going to be affecting this so that it perhaps can only move in one direction or another. Now, as we consider the issue of person under the guise of considering man as fallen and then man as regenerate, in both cases, we're going to have to consider that as an attribute of a fallen nature, but enacted in the first instance by a person who remains in his sin, and in the second instance by a person who is redeemed. And so there are two different equations that come into effect, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. There are some other things that come into play as well, things that we must consider. So as we consider then man in a state of innocency, we're talking about man when his nature is upright. His nature is still upright. He is possessed of an innate righteousness, a conformity to the law. God created him in his image, and it is then the duty of the person possessing that nature to maintain that righteousness in which he was created. Right? So that the will and the person bearing that will are both in a state of innocence. They're both uncorrupted by sin. They're both, as we consider them, in fact, they're both able either to sin or not to sin, to do that which is good or not to do that which is good. So that there is a natural freedom and power of will, which we'll talk about a little bit again. I think it's necessary to talk about that and to keep emphasizing that the will itself is possessed of a certain kind of freedom. Remember, as we talked about last time, it's not an unlimited or unbounded freedom. Only God has that unlimited or unbounded freedom, that freedom which is not circumscribed by something else. In the case of man, obviously that is not going to be part of the equation. So when we talk about freedom, we're talking about freedom always in a limited or a circumscribed way anyway. And the same with power. Power that man has is derivative, it's subordinate, it's not absolute power like God has. Man doesn't have an absolute power. Man is not able to affect everything he desires. But he is able to affect things that he desires. Just not everything. So there's a freedom and there's a power of will to do that. And in the state of innocence, and this is important because this is really the next clause is drawing a contrast with what will follow in the next section. And that is that he's able to will and do that which is good. His nature being upright, his nature being as it was from the hand of God, there is, in fact, no rational judgment arising, suggesting itself to that nature that is, in fact, going to make it incapable of doing that which is good. One thing that, and this is really a little bit of a different discussion, but to help you hopefully understand what we're talking about. Later in the development of Christian dogma, there's a discussion over something called monothelitism, the idea that Christ had only one will rather than two. The Orthodox position is that there are two wills in Christ. Because will is an attribute of nature. There are two natures or two wills. There is, but there's only one agent of willing. It's one person. Nonetheless, there are two wills present in Christ. And as we think about that, one thing that's said about the human will of Christ, because his nature is unfallen, his will is inclined always to do that which is good, because the nature is unfallen. And that's very different from the estate that man is going to enter into in the fall. When man enters into the state of the fall, he develops what some of the early church fathers called gnomic will. That is, he enters into a state of doubt. It's the same state you see, and this is how we know that man fell before he even ate from the tree. That the first sin was not pride, but unbelief. That the first sin really resolves itself into an initial unbelief. Yea, hath God said. And there's a hesitation on the part of man. In very much in contrast to the temptation of Christ by the devil, where Christ is very adamant in his response. There's no pause, there's no silence, there's no gap in thinking. It's very clear, a clear way forward. What the man embraces in the fall is gnomic will. It's a place where we feel the need to deliberate. We don't just simply enact, but we have to deliberate. And we have to deliberate because we're now corrupted by sin. And so we have to really think about what is really good and what is not really good. A lot of things have become gray areas for us. Not because they're gray areas, but because we're sinners. And that's where the gnomic will comes in. And that's where the problem of our indecisiveness and doubt is really found, in this realm of gnomic will. When you find yourself doubting, the early fathers would say you're in the realm of gnomic will. You know, when you know God's will and you do it, there's not any doubt. There's no doubts in this. So the point is, in a state of innocence, until man actually enters into a state of unbelief and falls, he doesn't have this gnomic will. He doesn't have this foggy region. This moral fog has not descended. You know, man has to sort of reach out and grab that moral fog in the beginning, which is not the point of what we're talking about here. We're really talking about the power of will. So I want you to understand the power of will was, in innocence, in a very real sense, a direct intuition of what was good, moral, upright. You didn't have to deliberate. You didn't need all of that. You didn't need more information. Things should have presented themselves exactly as they were. Good or evil, you should have recognized them for what they were. And in a state of innocence, man did. The problem that man runs into is, in recognition of what is good, that is, God said do this, once the serpent starts speaking, there begins this debate. And that's where the fall originates. It creates this unbelief, and unbelief, when it's enacted, leads to the fall. It's confirmed in by the agent upon the nature. It's the person imprints the nature, if you will. So, question one, did man, in his state of innocence, have freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing to God? The answer is yes, Genesis 1:26.
And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth.
Yeah, let us make man in our own image. Well, that language alone tells us that man was created upright. There could be no defect as he came from the hand of God. If God made him in his own image, he's not creating something inherently defective. Not physically and certainly not morally. Right? There's a state of innocency. And in that, as we talked about last time, the fact is that the power to will, the freedom to will, all of that is what makes man a genuine moral agent, not simply a robot, not simply some sort of biologically determined being or metaphysically determined being. That's not really how things work. Man is not conscious, as I said before, of any external or internal constraint, which we'll come back to again today for just another mention or two. Right? A creature can be no more morally independent of God in its actions and powers than it can be naturally independent of Him. Look at Acts 17:25-28.
Acts 17:25. Neither is worshipped with man's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. In verse 28, for in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring.
In him we live and move and have our being. We're dependent upon him. He, in fact, has established the law, the moral target at which we are shooting. Remember, sin, amartia, is missing the mark. It's to miss the mark. It's to go astray is to miss the mark. God is the one who set the mark. He's put the target. So the creature is not morally independent of God any more than he is naturally independent of God. We're not saying that. We say free will. In fact, most of the problems that people have, I think, with the concept of free will comes from beginning with this idea that what we possess today is free will. in the sense that they think that they can equally do good or evil. Well, you haven't really been able to do that since the fall. Again, I don't want to get into that. That really is the subject for next time. But when we're talking about free will, if we really want to understand free will as it is intended, we would understand it in terms of man in a state of innocence. But even more so, as we'll see at the end, man in a state of glory. So there's no moral independence. There's no natural independence. Man is dependent upon God to establish canons of morality. That is what's right and wrong. You know, the very nature of the temptation was allowing man to establish canons of morality. You know, the devil is really asking or suggesting that, you know, in the day that you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will be like God, determining what is good or what is evil. You're going to be doing that. Why? Well, because in the very act of eating, you have already suggested that the will of God in matters of morality is not enough. You think you have a contending will that has as much right to enact as the will of God has to command. You have the right to enact contrary. So, we're not saying there's moral independence any more than there's natural independence. Creature, as a creature, must acknowledge the Creator's will as its supreme law. Luke 20:38.
For he is not a God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him.
All live unto him. It is part of the created being that all live unto him. That is, the direction of all things are toward him. There has to be an acknowledgement of the Creator's will, which is why when we talk about Judgment Day, you know, we say that every knee shall bow and every tongue confess and so on. Every creature will acknowledge. That's going to happen. It must be so that a creature as a creature must acknowledge the supreme law. Now, in a state of innocence, this acknowledgement was, in fact, unconstrained. There needed to be no constraint to get the creature to do that. Right? The fact is that the creature was both able and willing to do so. And as long as the creature is both able and willing, then there's no disruption of harmony between the creator and the creature. That's a state of innocence. Right? When there's been no disruption, when there's been no disorder, when the will of the creature is set to do the will of the Creator. Not by any external constraint, not by any internal constraint, but simply because it represents the supreme desire of the creature to do the will of the Creator. Likewise, as it cannot be without him, so it must not be but for him, and according to his will. Proverbs 16:4.
Proverbs 16:4. The Lord hath made all things for himself, yea, even the wicked for the day of evil.
The Lord has made all things for himself, yea, even the wicked for the day of evil. That is to say, again, that not only do they have to acknowledge all creatures as creatures, have to acknowledge his will, supreme law, They can't be without him, they have to be for him, and according to his will. Ultimately, even the wicked, right, exist to do the will of God. They're going to do it whether or not they intended to. And yet, they do it willingly. They enact it willingly. What they do, what they an act is all, in fact, what they desire to enact. There's no, there's not even any internal constraint. But as I said before, all that God need do in these situations is you have sinners who would be more than happy to commit a myriad of sins. God, in the directing of providence, brings into actualization certain situations so that certain sins and not other sins are the ones that the sinner enacts. And those sins are all subordinate to, by his permission, subordinate to his supreme purpose, which is to bring glory to himself. They'll all work to that end. They're all working to that end, whether they see it as that or not, whether they perceive it or not. We should. Because the Lord has made all things for himself, yea, even the wicked, for the day of evil. Now, with that said, we can say, in addition, that no law obliges man until it's revealed. Romans 4:15.
Because the law works wrath. Where no law is, there is no transgression.
Yeah, where no law is, there's no transgression. But what does that tell us then? That it has to be that man, in his state of innocence, that there was a law which man as a rational creature was subjected to in his creation, that this law was revealed to him. It's in him. It's what we would say concreted in him. That's natural moral law. It's a law in him. And we know that it's there. Paul actually refers to this when he's talking about the heathen and the sense of morality that they have, even though they don't have Mosaic law, even though they don't have the publication of the Ten Commandments, yet as to the substantial natural morality of those commandments, they do have that. All right, look at Romans 2, 14 and 15.
Romans 2, 14 and 15. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are laws themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, and meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another.
So what man has in a state of innocence is a clear view of the law. It's a clear intuition of the law. It's been concreted in him. It's who he is. That's the point. Scripture tells us God made man upright.
Ecclesiastes 7:29. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions.
Okay, God made man upright. God made man in a state of moral righteousness. He did not make him in a neutral state. A state of innocence is actually a state in which he is possessing in his nature a clear and direct intuition of natural morality. He has that. It's his possession. It's part of the nature of man. It's necessary because his rationality, his reasoning, remember we talked about his rational judgment. Rational judgment can only be formed with reference to these canons of morality. You know, how do we know right from wrong? We know it because it's written in our hearts. Now, it's taken a pretty bad twist and turn because of the fall. We'll talk about that later. But for now, it's important to understand that in a state of innocency, it's not that. And because man has this direct intuition, this direct apprehension, direct understanding of the law in its intent, you know, the plenitude of its meaning, because man has that, there was no room in man in a state of innocency for that idea of gnomic will, which, as I say, some of the early fathers talk about arising in man after the fall. There's no place where man is going to pause. You know, he's not going to be in a state of hesitation. He doesn't need to be told, for example, choose, you know, like we'll see in a moment in some of these verses, you know, set before you good or evil. Therefore, choose the good. He doesn't need to be told, choose the good. He doesn't even need to be told, I set before you good and evil. The man knows that what has been set before him is good. And he also knows, because God told him, because this would not have been an intuition, an immediate intuition, he knows that God has said to him, but of that tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I don't want you to eat it. That's positive morality. But he also knows that when God tells him that it is a good thing to obey God. There's no blurry area, no area where any of the intuiting of what is right and wrong, good and evil, there's no place here where the man should be hesitating, pausing, deliberating, or anything else, because in a state of innocence, he is ready and able to enact and go forward on that which is good and upright, because he himself is good and upright. You know, he knows what answers to that. When you see something good, I mean, in a sense, you don't need to see every human being on the face of the earth, but if you were to be dropped down out of the sky any place on earth, it doesn't matter how different the human being. If you see a human being rather than an animal, you're going to recognize a human being. You recognize a human being for being a human being and not something else. In a moral sense, it's the same thing going on here. You recognize what is right and good and just and true, because what is right and good and just and true is what is written in your heart. You don't need anybody to tell you that. You don't even need to pause and think about it. So man in his state of innocence is actually at that point of what we call rational spontaneity. You know, all rational spontaneity of the man in a state of innocence is really going to be for the good. He's able to do that which is good. But it's mutable. We'll get to that. It's mutable. But he's able to do that which is good. He has the freedom and the power of doing that which is good and well-pleasing to God. Right, so if man is upright, again, that supposes a law to which he was conformed in his creation. And that's what we call the natural moral law. Genesis 9:6.
Genesis 9:6. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man.
Yeah, the argument here for capital punishment is actually rooted in the image of God. Man is created in the image of God. That we know inherently that there is something wrong with murder. We know that we have, when we murder someone, we're striking at the image of God. And that's the basis for the moral prohibition or unjust killing. It's also the basis for capital punishment, putting to death the murderer. You know, it's no mistake, as societies move further and further away from Christianity, try to bury that in oblivion, that they find this idea of imposing a death penalty more difficult, more troublesome, because post-Christian society is actually worse than pagan society in this way. Pagan societies have and remain clear in their apprehension that there is a problem here. You know, non-Christian societies generally have had no problem enacting death penalties for things like murder. Post-Christian societies are the societies that tend to have a problem with this concept, because you're suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. Nonetheless, it's written on the heart. It's part of that natural morality. We know it, and it shows us that there is a law in the heart of man that shows that in his original creation, because remember, this discussion in Genesis 9 is after the fall, but in his original creation, he bore a complete resemblance to that righteousness which is in the law, because that law was, the work of that law was written in his heart. He had a natural knowledge of it. Right, so man's righteousness consisted in conformity to this rule or law. Acts 26:14.
Acts 26:14. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue,
Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks.
Sorry, Acts 24:16.
Acts 24:16, and herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men.
Okay, we have a conscience void of offense toward God and men. Why is Paul concerned about that? Well, he understands that man's righteousness consists in those two aspects. And what is he talking about? Remember, the first table of the law is man's duty toward God. The second table of the law is man's duty toward man. Having a conscience void of offense toward God and man is the same as saying, I'm seeking conformity to that innate righteousness, that natural morality. I have a sense of that. And if I'm going to be righteous, I need to be conformed to that. Having a conscience void of offense is having, in fact, a sense that I am in conformity to that which I know to be right. I'm seeking to do that which is I know to be right, and I'm seeking to avoid that which I know to be wrong. Those aspects of natural morality, the things which, in fact, compose natural morality. Man's righteousness is conformed to that. And that, again, it means that he's conformed to that con-created natural morality. He's in line with that. Right now, there is a twofold conformity required of man. Right? There's a conformity to the powers of his soul to the law, which is called habitual righteousness, and a conformity to all his actions to it, which is actual righteousness. Look at Proverbs 20:7.
Proverbs 20:7. The just man walketh in his integrity, and children are blessed after him.
A just man walketh in his integrity. That is, he has an integrity. That is, there's an habitual righteousness, and he walks in it. That's actual righteousness. Yeah.
Which is pretty much the exact opposite of original sin, natural sin.
What's this?
This is pretty much the exact opposite of original sin and actual sin.
Yes, right. Habitual righteousness is the original state in which man was created. He had a habitual, he was created in a state of habitual righteousness, right? That's man made, was made by God habitually righteous. Look at Genesis 1:26.
Genesis 1:26. God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth.
Right, and man was to make himself actually righteous. For example, Psalm 26:1.
Psalm 26:1. Judge me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity. I have trusted also in the Lord, therefore I shall not slide.
Okay, so habitual righteousness is how God made man. He put him in a habit of righteousness. All his nature, the power of his nature. Man's nature was, in fact, habitually righteous. In and through the person of Adam. And this is why we say that with regard to the covenant of works, that Adam, if you remember the catechism talks about this, the condition of the covenant of works was personal, perfect, and perpetual obedience. Right? Why is it personal? Well, you see, although the nature of man, as coming from the hand of God, is in a state of habitual righteousness, the person himself remains undetermined until he either owns or disowns that. And that's what the period of trial was about. In a state of innocence, Adam could wield that will one way or another. He could either confirm it and then God would confirm it in him, as he did in the elect angels, who kept their first estate, or he could deny it. But the only way he could deny it is not in his nature, but through his person. It was through his person, and denying it through his person, that he corrupts the whole nature. Because in him the nature was undivided. Christ comes to reverse all of that, by the way. Okay, that's one of the things going on there when we think about what Christ is doing. He is, in fact, confirming that original or habitual righteousness that man has through the agency of his divine person. He's confirming it in man. And then that is confirmed by God. Adam doesn't do that. But God made, in a state of innocence, God made him habitually righteous. As to his habitus, that is, as to every inclination. There's no inclination to do unrighteousness. There's no inclination to sin. There's nothing in his nature to lead him astray. When the deviation comes, it comes personally. Just as the will, you know, the will and the human nature, that doesn't exist in abstraction. It always exists in actual possession of a person. The person imprints. That's what personhood does. It imprints upon the nature. So this is why, in terms of Trinitarian theology, we talk about the Son being the express image, the character. The Greek word means imprint of the Father. He's the express imprint of the Father's person, hypostasis. Person is imprinting nature. If Adam continues in a state of uprightness, if he is actively obedient in the state of original righteousness, then at the end of the trial period, that is confirmed to him, and he's established in it. That is, he has taken what was abstract, habitual righteousness, and he's made it personal, actual righteousness. He could have done that. That's our point here with man in a state of innocence. He could have done that. And I want you to understand the propositions, because when we get to the next section, hopefully you'll understand that while the person imprints and confirms the nature, the person can't change the nature. So once the nature's fallen, there's no power in the person to change the nature. And that's why Adam's fall into sin is so devastating. And that's why what Christ comes to do is so amazing and so necessary. Because the person can't change that. So what Adam is doing, because all of the human nature resides in him, is he's imprinting it. He is, in fact, feeding it its genetic code, if you will, for all, the whole human race. What he does is going to affect. This is why there are family sins. You know, this is why we see sins transmitted in family lines. Families tend in this way or that way. There are realities that have to do with our descent in humanity. You know, certain groups of people are more prone to this or to that. It's real because of this. And no matter what the person would like, there are limitations that are imposed on every person due to the human nature as we've received it. Now in Adam, he has the whole humanity undivided in him. What he does affects everyone. He imprints either that establishment in righteousness, or he imprints sin. So Adam's personal sin becomes our original sin. And that's why the guilt of that original sin is imputed to us. It's imputed to us because, as we'll see when we get to it, we, as persons who are born in sin, all we can do is confirm it. But we'll talk about that next time. All right. So God made man habitually righteous. Man owes to make himself actually righteous. Okay. The state into which man was created is called the state of original righteousness. And to understand it a little bit, I just want to look at 1 Corinthians 11:7. It's a different topic, but there's something interesting said here that I think has bearing on this.
1 Corinthians 11:7. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man.
Yeah, in as much as he is the image and glory of God, what is man doing? Well, he is, in fact, not only his image, but he is the glory of God. That is to say, he is, in fact, reflecting that image back. Just like the Father, the image of the Father is reflected back in the Son, the image of God is reflected back through the creation, through the intelligent creation in particular. So Adam, in his state of original righteousness, is reflecting back this righteousness of God that he has innate. He's giving full, really full revelation of that in his being. He's revealing what is inside him as he keeps the law, as he does what is right, as he proceeds in a way morally uncorrupt. That is reflecting, that is the glory of God. Now, this original righteousness, we know, consisted really of three things. Right. First of all, man's understanding, which in his state of innocence, he was a lamp of light. We'll get Proverbs 20:27.
Proverbs 20:27. The spirit of man is the candle of the Lord, searching all the inward parts of the belly.
Man, in his state of innocence, His understanding was light. There was no darkness in it. There wasn't any area where he couldn't see clearly. It was all light. When you have the light of God without and the light of God within, everything is light. There's this perfect conformity, which again is why there's no gnomic will. There's no area of doubtful disputation. There's no point at which he's going to hesitate or should hesitate. Not according to knowledge. Knowledge and understanding. A perfect knowledge of the law, and a perfect knowledge of his duty according to the law. He was made after God's image and consequently couldn't lack knowledge, which is a part thereof. Colossians 3:10.
Colossians 3:10. And put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him.
God gave man an innate knowledge. Where did man, by the way, get the knowledge, for example, to name all the animals? When God brings those animals to him and says to him, you know, what is this? Adam looks on these animals and he's able to call them what they are. And he names them what they are. When Eve is brought to him, he calls her Eve, the mother of all living. He recognizes her for what she is. He doesn't need a voice from heaven telling him, because he has a voice from heaven within him, enlightening him. He has that knowledge. He's possessed of a clear understanding of the creation, its intent, its purpose, its function. He's able to do all of that. He can name the animals. He knows what they are. He looks at it and he says, I know what that is. This is before sin has entered in. This is before sin has corrupted man's knowledge. Adam had a law written upon his mind, the knowledge thereof being concreted with him, as the remains of it upon the heathen do testify. Again, Romans 2:14-15.
Romans 2:14-15. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are lawless themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, but meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another.
Okay, so original righteousness has to do with understanding. Second, it has to do with his will. His will was in all things agreeable to the will of God. I'm going to look at Romans 12:2.
Romans 12:2, and be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God.
Yeah, this idea that believers should prove what is a good and acceptable will of God, we don't have to prove it. Or he didn't have to prove it. He just simply did it. It came natural to him. Like breathing. Like drinking water when you're thirsty. There was nothing confusing in his mind. And so when he willed, all that he willed was agreeable to the will of God. There's nothing else. There isn't any other thing to consider. You notice when sin arises in man, it arises from an outside source. The serpent is more subtle, and it comes into the garden. It comes through that hedge. It's breached the hedge. Comes through that hedge. And it makes its way. Right? But there was no corruption in his will. There's no bent or inclination to evil. For that sin, properly and truly so called. Romans 7:7.
Romans 7:7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Nay, I had not known sin but by the law, for I had not known lust except the law had said, thou shalt not covet.
Yeah, so there was no bent or inclination. That comes after the fall. But if we want to understand really what we're talking about here a little bit, consider Christ. He's come to do the will of his Father. You know, that's the kind of will we're talking about. Now, it's a little muddled with Christ, mainly because Christ is doing it in the midst of a world that is ravaged by sin. And Adam doesn't have to deal with all of that. But the idea is that Adam simply does the will of his Father. Right? He just does what God would have him do. There's no corruption there. Right? The will was disposed by its original make to follow the Creator's will as the shadow does the body. Look at Ephesians 4:24.
Ephesians 4:24. And that you put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness.
So, again, he has the understanding, that perfect understanding. There's no defect in his will. His will is going to, rational judgment, when you have a clear intuition of what is the good, rational judgment is going to lead the will. It's going to lead the way for the will. You're going to will according to rational judgment, and that's going to mean your will is going to be in full conformity to the will of God. There's no reason to deviate. There is no deviation. You know, on your horizon, there's nothing presenting itself that as a contest. There's no gray area. There's no gnomic will that's in a state of deliberation. You don't have to deliberate. You're just doing it. You're living, breathing, eating God's will. That's what you want to do, which is our third point. His affections were orderly, pure, and holy.
James 3:9. Therewith blessed we God, even the Father, and therewith cursed we men, which are made after the similitude of God.
Yeah, there's no disorderliness in our affections, in a state of innocence, I should say, in Adam's affections in a state of innocence. So he's got perfect understanding. His will is conformed to that understanding. His affections are orderly. And the way the devil is going to corrupt all of this is really an appeal to the baser appetite, affections, and work his way through to the will and understanding of man. Satan is very subtle in coming at man. He hits you where you are most likely to burst open. But Adam doesn't have this problem, at least from the hand of the Creator. He's not disorderly in his affections. Now, the apostle petitions the Lord, straighten your hearts to the love of God. 2 Thessalonians 3:5.
2 Thessalonians 3:5. And the Lord direct your hearts into the love of God and into the patient waiting for Christ.
Yeah, direct your hearts in the love of God. What is that? We need to be directed because we're corrupted. Our affections are disordered. But again, we're told man was made thus straight as he came from the hand of God. Once more, Ecclesiastes 7:29.
Ecclesiastes 7:29. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright. They have sought out many inventions.
Right. So man's affections in this primitive state were pure from all defilement. There's no defiling of them. They're not disordered. They're not distempered. Philippians 2:7.
But made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men.
He's made in the likeness of men. Now, if there's something inherently distempered or disordered about being a man, surely the Son of God would not have made himself in that likeness. He would not have taken upon himself human nature if there's something inherently sinful or defiled about it. There isn't. Now, as it came from the hand of God, that nature is, in fact, undefiled. And thus, man, in the state of innocence, he was endued with power not only to will, but to will that which was good, having been created in the image of God. Genesis 5:1-2.
This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him. Male and female created he them, and blessed them, and called their name Adam, in the day when they were created.
So as man is in a state of innocence, he has that freedom and power to will and do that which is good and well-pleasing to God. Now, again, we can ask this question, wherein consists the freedom and the power to will? What exactly is that again? Let's look at it briefly. So I don't think we can think about this enough. The freedom of the will consists in a natural liberty from any external compulsion, whereby it's forced or constrained to act, that is, from some external agent. Right? Look at John 8:33.
John 8:33. They answered him, "We be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, ye shall be made free?"
You know, we're never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, we shall be made free? It's natural liberty. You know, we understand that idea, that if you're being constrained by some external agent, that you're not really free. But we're saying, no, there's a freedom here. There's a real freedom. It also consists in a liberty from any psychological internal constraint, whereby it could not enact the desires formed in accordance with the faculty of rational judgment. For example, look at 1 Corinthians 7:37.
1 Corinthians 7:37. Nevertheless, he had standing steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but had power over his own will, and had so decreed in his heart that he will keep his version, do it well.
Yeah, has power over his own will. I know it's talking about some thing other altogether. I don't want to get into that, but the point that I want to make from that verse is Paul's talking about people who have power over their own will. There is not an internal constraint. That's important to understand, that this there is a natural liberty. There's a natural freedom and power of the will to act or not. Which is why when we do act, it is very clearly representative of who we are, which we'll come back to in just a moment. All right, so the will consists then in an unconstrained ability to choose as to both the object, that is to choose this rather than that, and its subject. The agent does so voluntarily. Look at
Joshua 24:15. And if it seems evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.
Yeah, that, again, I talked about that earlier, that this language of choosing, where God sets before you things, it is presuming, and if now, how much more so in a state of innocence, this idea that the will has the ability to choose this rather than that, and that the person doing the choosing is doing so voluntarily. You know, there's no internal or external constraint. There's a power to one rather than the other. There's also no internal or external constraint. Now, all of this talk presupposes, as I said earlier, that the will, like the mind, is an attribute of the nature of man, which takes its peculiar character from the agent or individual giving expression to that will. Ezekiel 18:4.
Ezekiel 18:4. Behold, all souls are mine, as the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son is mine. The soul that sinneth shall die.
And the soul that sinneth, it shall die. It is, in fact, when the will is put into action, when men enact, when they will and enact, what they're doing is they're giving rise to a revelation of character. They're the peculiar character of the agent, the person enacting and willing. That's what comes to the fore in each act of willing, and that's why the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Okay. There is, in fact, a confirmation in the actor, in the agent, of the nature and character of the soul. So the will The will is that which is really it is that which gives man the ability to display the character of the person. You know, the person, the character of the person is actually, and this is why I think the Bible says the soul that sinneth it shall die. Because the character of the person, remember, is what is being imprinted on the nature. And that's the soul. That it's being imprinted there. The person is imprinted. There's an express imprinting going on again and again. Thus then, the freedom and power of the will is that of the nature of man in a man. It is the freedom and power of agency. Now look, for example, at Ruth 1:15 and 16.
Ruth 1:15 and 16. And she said, "Behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law." And Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God."
What is she doing? She's expressing the freedom and power of agency. She can do this or she can do that. She can do so voluntarily. That's will. Ultimately, will is giving expression to that power and that freedom. And it's freedom and power of the will then corresponds to the freedom and power of the nature, and it accurately reflects this nature through the personal agency of a man.
2 Samuel 15:21. And Ittai answered the king and said, "As the Lord liveth, and as my lord the king liveth, surely in what place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also will thy servant be."
Okay, so the freedom and power of the will is in correspondence to the freedom and power of the nature. And the nature of man in innocency is, in fact, able to do that which is spiritually good, and yet mutable.
Right.
It reflects that nature. The will is reflecting the nature through the personal agency of the man. Want to know about the nature? Look at the personal agency. Right. But there's another thing. In other words, when a person enacts his nature, what he's doing is he's making personal the freedom and power of the nature he possesses. I want to look at Romans 5:12.
Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned.
Yeah, wherefore by one man death entered into the world by sin, and it passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. But what that means is, men, and this is a big part of Paul's argument here in Romans 5, not only is our nature sinful, not only are we possessed of original sin, but we own it. We show forth that we really are sinners by enacting it personally. See, we imprint on that corrupted nature our own personal corruption. You know, we're ratifying that. It's like saying, yeah, that's mine. That's taking a signet ring and stamping it, that wax of nature, and saying, that's me. Now, Adam, as long as he was walking upright, what he's doing is saying, yeah, that's me. I am by nature created in the image of God. I'm upright. This is the power that man has in innocency. Had he remained in that to the end of the trial, he would have been confirmed in that, established in that, just like the elect angels. So when we talk about the problem of original sin and the actual sins that flow from it, we also do need to remember that the actual sins that flow from it are the source and reason for what we would call things like family sins and sins that characterize groups of people that descend from a common father. This is the way this stuff works. Right, so in a state of innocency, there's a power, there's a freedom and power to will, and it's a freedom and power that corresponds to that unbounded purity of nature that man has as he comes forth in the hand of God. The last question then, was this freedom and power to will mutable so that man might fall from it? And this is really introducing us to the next point that we are going to talk about in a lot of detail next time. But that is yes. The fact is that Adam in his state of innocence was a free agent. He was created with holy affections and moral tendencies. Look at Psalm 25:8 and Genesis 1:27.
Psalm 25:8. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore will he teach sinners in the way.
Genesis 1:27, so God created man in his own image, in the image of God created he him, male and female created he them.
And what is the image of God? Well, good and upright is the Lord. He created man good and upright because he created him in his own image. Right? He's a free agent, though. That is, the person that's going to enact the will is not determined. The nature of this person, Adam, is upright, holy, good. His will corresponds to that. It's holy, good, and upright. So he's in a state of original righteousness. It's a habit of righteousness. What God has done is put him in a garden and said, look, here's a period, a trial period. What we called in chapter 7, the covenant of works. What you need to do is you need to enact that original or habitual righteousness. You need to put that into action. You need to confirm it in your person. Should you do so, having confirmed it in your person, God, according to the covenant works, said he would confirm it in the person of Adam for all men. Covenant of works. So Adam has all of that in a state of innocence, and yet with the character is yet unconfirmed. That is, his person, his personal agency. It's capable of obedience, yet liable to be seduced by external temptation, by the inordinate excitement of the propensions of his animal nature, such as in their proper degree and due subordination, or innocent in and of themselves. For example, 1 Corinthians 9, 25 and 27.
1 Corinthians 9, verses 25 and 27. Verse 25. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. And verse 27. But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I should have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway.
So, affections are okay, desires are fine, as long as they are kept in their proper degree and due subordination. There's an innocency. The problem is when desires are elevated above that which is, in fact, right. In Adam's case, should his affections be elevated above his holy, righteous, upright nature? and will. Everything could be turned upside down because the personal agency, that character had not yet been impressed upon the nature in a way in which it would be confirmed. See, in Christ, that holiness of character is confirmed on the human nature. He's impressed it with his divine image all over again. Adam didn't do that. Adam fell. He was mutable. His will was not absolutely indifferent to good or evil because God set it towards good only. Again, Ecclesiastes 7:29.
Ecclesiastes 7, verse 9. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions.
Right. Yet we have to say it was not fixed or confirmed in its inclination so that it couldn't be altered. For example, Psalm 103:14 and 1 Chronicles 29:18.
Psalm 103, verse 14. For he knoweth our frame, he remembereth that we are dust.
1 Chronicles 29, verse 18. O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Israel, our fathers, keep this forever in the imagination of the thoughts of the heart of thy people. Prepare their heart unto thee.
Prepare their heart unto thee. He knows our frame, that we're dust. That word frame, he knows our frame. That actually means our inclination. He knows that we're inclined to dust. That's our frame. That's because we've been taken from the dust. He knows that. That's what makes us mutable. Sin is not arising in the soul and moving to the body. Sin approaches the soul through the body. It begins at that lowest aspect of the body, the lowest consideration, its most animal affections. Strikes there. Sin comes at man respecting what he's going to eat. Just like we see with the temptation with Christ in the wilderness. Right? There's an attempt to get at man through his corporeal body, through that which is most connected to this world and least connected to God, at least from the point of view of metaphysics. So, man's freedom and power to will, which corresponds to his nature, is mutable. It's not fixed. It's not yet confirmed because there's been no impress of character upon it, which itself has been confirmed, establishing it in that original righteousness. Right? It was movable to evil. And in that sense, it was movable to evil only by the man himself. Genesis 2:16 and 17 and Genesis 3:6.
Genesis 2:16 and 17. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die.
Genesis 3, verse 6. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat.
You see all the language there leading up to the fall. It's language discussing the affections of the man, you know, how he perceived, how he really kind of how he felt about you know, how his desires were changing. His affections were being tampered with in this temptation. But the man himself is the one, and the only one, who could, in fact, move in such a way as to impress upon this nature that corruption of sin. Right. Man is changeable. And the reason is, if Adam had been unchangeably righteous, it would have to be either by nature or by free gift. Look at Romans 11:35.
For who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again?
Yeah, who hath given him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again? In other words, there is, in fact, there's nothing, in other words, that we're going to give to God. We're not in a position to bring anything to God. So if there's an unchangeable righteousness, it either had to be by nature or it has to be by gift. Right? Now, here's what we can say, I think, with respect to that proposition. The first, it couldn't be by nature. The reason is immutability is an attribute proper to God alone. It's incommunicable to any creature.
James 1:17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning.
So variableness, neither shadow of turning with him. It is God alone who is immutable. Right? That is an attribute of uncreated being. So, had God given this to us by nature, we would be created gods, if you will. And that is an oxymoron. If you really understand the nature of uncreated being is just that, it's uncreated being. And only uncreated being is in fact, immutable, unchangeable. On the other hand, if it was to be by free gift, then it was that confirmation, the state of original righteousness, would have been the reward of grace given upon continuance in righteousness through the trial state. This is a covenant of works. It actually is. It was intended to be given by gift. Not by nature, but by gift. That's what happened with the angels that were confirmed in their first estate. And that's essentially what man is going through, what we call the covenant of works. He's been put in a very similar position, right? As was pledged by the tree in the garden. Genesis 2:9.
Genesis 2:9. And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
The tree of life in the midst of the garden. We can't have life in and of ourselves, as does the divine being, God. Right? Uncreated being has life in itself. But can we have life as gift? Can we be confirmed in that by way of gift? Well, yes, just as the elect angels. So the covenant of works was about this, and there was a pledge in that tree in the midst of the garden for this life. That's what was being aimed at. You know, all Adam needed to do was complete the trial, be confirmed in that original righteousness, and that confirmation would in fact have been transmitted to all those who descended from him by ordinary generation. All he needed to do was impress upon the nature, the character of his person enacting that nature. And in a state of innocence, he could have done that. It was fully within his ability and disposition. That is incontrovertible. Right. Having said all of that, we have to remember this primitive state of a wholly infallible nature. We really have no experience, and consequently, our comprehension is always going to be very imperfect. John 3:11.
John 3:11. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, we speak that we do know, and testify that we have seen, and ye receive not our witness.
Yeah, we speak what we know and what we've seen, and we can testify of that. So, this is a very difficult thing to imagine, and even some of the better examples that we have of what it would have looked like, we have from Christ, when we see Christ in action. And yet, when he's enacting in a situation involving sinners, that doesn't quite give us the same picture, because Adam was not faced with any of that. Adam was able to enact without facing what we call the contradiction of sinners.
Yeah.
The very things that Christ had to endure. So our understanding of what was going on here is imperfect, although, again, we do know and we can understand some things. So we need to understand and believe that, you know, Adam had both the freedom and power to will that which was good. So that when he didn't, and he didn't, there's no one to blame but himself. You know, you can't look outside of that. He had all of that. He had the ability, as I said in the beginning, to will to sin or not to sin. To will to do good or not to do good. And by his sin, there is an impress of that character of the person on the wax of humanity that affects all men. We call it original sin. And original sin, which characterizes all men who now descend from him by ordinary generation, that original sin does have an impact upon the ability to will, the freedom and the power to will. The will has a natural freedom and power, but because of sin, that natural freedom and power, which are corresponding to the nature of man, have been changed indelibly. And that's what we want to talk about next time, when we take up the question of the state of man's will after the fall, in the state of sin.